Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to podcast number 12 of the Strong Source Podcast. We have here a very special guest because I know him already for a very long time. He's the CCO of Interfood. He learned me tips and tricks of the world of dairy trading. And I arrived there actually as a junior trader all the way in the south part of the Netherlands to become a dairy trader, where actually I could pioneer my way into the world of dairy, buying and selling skim milk powders, butters, whole milk powders. We went from Greece to exhibitions in Italy to France to Sweden. It was an amazing time, learned a lot. And I think that if I would describe you, I think you're commercially one of the best guys that I know. I think you are a very strong asset in Interfood. And that's why I think you're also now the CCO, because it's not easy to work in a known family business and also to achieve what you have achieved. Because I think as well that you have one of the best years ever now in your company. And those results don't come just by accident. And I think that also is because the other thing is you see opportunities. And I think you saw that with futures, and of course also with other people in the team. And I think now you're very much focused also on sustainability and other topics. So I think there you have an eye for these kind of commercial opportunities. I learned a lot, and it was in 2012 that I started there. And now we work together, but then I sell you the Vesper Intelligence. So that's cool again. So the circle is round and now in the podcast. So welcome, Edwin. Very happy that you're here. So I look forward to this episode. Really cool.
Thank you, Sterk. Thanks for this kind introduction of Martijn Beijers and the Bird.
Yeah, no, I also like to say something to explain the audience how I know you, because I don't know you that long as Alex. I didn't know much about dairy commodities, because when I was head of cocoa trading for Cargill in the cocoa and chocolate business, the cocoa trading and chocolate trading was split. Another person in Cargill managed the dairy book for the chocolate business. So I knew about the dairy trade in terms of his results, his position results, but I never really analyzed the dairy market. Now, and obviously I got approached by Interfood at some stage to help you finding trading talent. And then I visited Interfood. I also looked at the website, downloaded the integrated report and was very impressed by it. And I was fortunate that you guys allowed me to attend the trading meeting. And it felt like being back in Cargill, sitting with like 30, 40 traders in one big room, very young, ambitious people, good discussions. And yeah, I was really impressed by it. And then I was also invited to do a presentation for the youngest group of traders in Interfood as part of the Trading Academy. That was super nice. And yeah, so now I follow Interfood obviously very closely, and also the dairy market. It's super interesting. And yeah, that is, I think, the bridge to the first question that I have is, when I thought about it and when I talk with young people about getting into the commodities industry, you think about metals, you think about energy, you think about agriculture. And agriculture, you think about grains and oilseeds to a large extent, cocoa, coffee, sugar, but not so much dairy. And I find it especially strange because everyone pretty much daily consumes dairy products, milk, cheese, whatever. So can you tell us why you think among commodity traders, dairy is not that well known?
Yeah, good question. So we discussed that also internally many times, and we don't have the exact answers there. And we do see that the dairy commodity industry is changing. To start with, the dairy market is actually much bigger than many other soft commodities. However, the difference is that dairy is consumed to a big extent, maybe 90% of its capacity, where it's made. So the product, there's no necessity to ship it around the way other soft commodities are being transported around the globe. Another reason is the future markets have not developed. And I assume it is because that necessity was not there. Maybe prices were more controlled in the past, I don't know, relatively to other commodities. And this has been changed over the last years. I think it was 2015 that the EU quota on production got released. And as of then, also, I think the future markets got organized. And over the past, I would say 5 to 10 years, we have seen a very rapid development of the exchanges around the world. But still, it's only a small portion of the physical traders' volumes. Whereas cocoa and many others, it's a multiple of the traded volume. So I think the opportunity is there. And I believe it's a market which is maybe slightly more conservative than others. So there's a lot of opportunity ahead of us. Yeah.
Yeah, I find it fascinating because you would think that any commodity market which is growing would like to have more opportunities for risk management. And especially when you do far deferred business, you want to be able to bridge the gap between the behavior of suppliers and consumers, because they actually, a supplier wants to sell when the market is high and a buyer wants to buy when the market is low. And that, in essence, that gap in behavior, you can use futures for that.
Yeah.
Now, so why is it not that in the dairy industry, as you say, that it is bigger than some of the soft commodities, that the industry is conservative and doesn't say, well, look, we need to stimulate this. And as always, liquidity is the key thing. Because if you know liquidity, then people are afraid of having a contract in their book, which maybe doesn't sufficiently mirror the underlying, where you can't easily get in and out when you want to. So what are you doing in industry groups to stimulate people to use the derivatives markets in dairy?
Yeah, it's a lot of education. So I believe why it hasn't been the success so far, maybe in Europe, relatively to Europe, to the US, is that many of the co-ops in the European dairy landscape have considered futures to be a risk element. So they didn't see it as an opportunity to risk and mitigate their risk on their contracts.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has been a lot of education, and gradually now see that there are dedicated risk managers being hired by the bigger companies. And as a result, we see liquidity increasing. But we need time for this change. I think most trading companies were ahead of the curve, as I think it goes for all industries. And now we see also other participants joining step by step. And I think this happens mostly through pain. So pain that they didn't hedge exposure. Bakery industry, we have seen huge price peaks on butterfat in the world markets. And again, we're heading now in again a peak, and I think it might pass the historical prices that we have seen over the past decade. And with this pain, you see gradually people getting more willing to look at these risk management solutions. At the same time, 3 years ago, many Irish co-ops, they forward contracted based on their milk price, a 3-year milk price at a fairly low cost. That was prior to the start of the war between Ukraine and Russia. And as a result, these farmers did not lock their input costs. So they were exposed. So they went short effectively and had to pay a big penalty to deliver those contracts. So I think over history, you see that gradually more and more participants are joining the game, but it comes also sometimes with a slowdown when certain people make mistakes, and gradually they adapt, get better at it. And I see the next 5 to 10 years, a lot of opportunity for markets around the world to further evolve and create more liquidity. Yeah.
Because if you look at now, so you guys do risk management now, like other traders and some of the producers and big FMCGs. But what do you think that, why did Interfood grow so fast? What is the success? Is the people? What did you change? What did you do differently?
I think above all, it's our company culture and the people that we have employed and the culture we have created all together. The purpose that brings us together, of together for better. That's how we service. That's how we look at teamwork internally, but also how we cooperate with our business partners around the world, trying to create value for them and with them. Next to this, I believe we have been innovating faster than many of the competitors in the industry. So as you were highlighting yourself around risk management, and the same applies to sustainability solutions right now, this is what the market is asking for. And if you're willing to invest maybe ahead of the benefits, then you can capture a part of that market there. And it's cool to see that people within the business are looking each and every time for new opportunities, and they're out there.
Yeah. And then for yourself, so when I started trading with you in the European team, you were also still young and you had some more experience than I did already in dairy, but now you're C-level in the company. What does that change in your role, basically, in the things that you do? What is it to be a C-level in a dairy trading company?
A good question. I think I made my career within Interfood in a very gradual way.
Yeah.
So it was step by step, moving away, starting as a junior trader, rolling into a trader, more senior position, ultimately running a book, becoming responsible for the whole franchise in Europe, moving abroad to Singapore, managing that office, that hub, and ultimately getting into the position of CCO where I'm today. So each and every time you become maybe slightly less operational, and I sense that the drive I got from doing a deal when I entered the business as a junior trader, I changed into getting energy of succeeding as a team or as a P&L, and the team each and every time got bigger. But still, I sensed that achieving that success as an organization was a big part of my drive into this role. And not only trading today is part of the day-to-day anymore. A lot involves strategy and teams and structure. But ultimately, I always have the trades and the customer demands in my mind working on all these elements of within our board meetings. And that, for me, is a good mix. Still being with the teams, sitting with the teams, hearing the day-to-day opportunities and challenges, helping them to be successful, and at the same time building a company that is ready for the future.
And you don't miss the trades?
I do. Every now and then I miss the trades, but it's through the applications that we've built, the team environment, and being able to see the trades that happen in China, in Brazil, in Poland on a day-to-day basis, allow me to still be there with them, with the teams, and maybe at times help them or prevent certain challenges from happening. So I still feel and consider myself as one of the traders within the organization. So I can't and I don't see myself as a management only. I see myself as a trader who evolved into a more managerial role over the past 16 years.
But then also you have different offices, right, around the world.
Yeah.
So how do you manage that? Because the people all over, you're responsible commercially. So how do you manage that basically within a trading company, these different places?
Well, effectively, we have the organization set up in three hubs. So there is an APAC hub, there's an Americas hub, and a European hub. There are three leaders of these P&Ls. And ultimately, they are responsible for managing their business. And that comes with trust, right? So you delegate that responsibility in full. And that's maybe a very interesting element because I struggled at the start in my CCO role when sometimes people within my team, board team, challenged me and said, but why don't you control that better? Or why don't you mitigate that position risk? Why don't you overrule them? And what I've sensed is the moment I start taking over their roles and start making the decisions that they have to make on a day-to-day basis, I start carrying the burden and I will have a dispute with them whether it was their decision or my decision to step out of an exposure or strategy. And I believe over the past years that delegation is very important in order to have them truly take that accountability and manage that P&L. So it is about finding the right people that can deal with that responsibility.
And is it then, do you think, so you've been in the cocoa, Martijn, you're in the dairy, Edwin. Do you think it's completely different when you have different offices around the world for dairy commodities than for cocoa, for other softs? Do you think it matters that you're different regions because they're both traded all over the world? You have different regions, different dynamics. Does it matter? Could a cocoa trader be fantastic for a dairy company or a trader be fantastic for a cocoa company?
Yeah, we had some discussions, Martijn and I, on that subject. And I'm maybe biased, but so far I've really struggled to see people from the outside succeed within our business. And Martijn challenged me and said in Cargill, I've seen multiple people succeed and move from cocoa to soy and to other ingredients.
Yeah.
Well, that made me reconsider and think about this.
What I see when people are successful within our company, and that's maybe how I can approach this question, is when they're successful, they are making their careers very rapidly. So I believe when you're very successful within Interfood and you make your career very quickly and you become certificate holder and you make impact and you're being rewarded and you make steps faster than others, I think most of the time you stay around. You don't move around. You don't move to a competitor or you don't move to another industry. So from that mindset, I sometimes struggle to see why people would move away from something they truly know.
Yep.
And I ask myself the question, what if in my past 15 years, I would have been reporting to someone within the trading community who didn't know the landscape of dairy well, would that be a problem to me? I might have challenged him a lot or her. So I don't know. I won't say it's not possible because I think other commodities and definitely the more advanced ones can bring something that we are looking for as a business to further advance and grow. But I think it's not easy.
Yeah.
I'd like to make some comments on that. So I think that you can learn something from all different commodities. And so I'm now reading, I'm almost finished reading The World for Sale. And that is, and we have the author soon in this podcast, Javier Blas. He knows a lot about cocoa, by the way. But the book, to a large extent, is about oil trading and energy trading. And now I'm almost finished. I'm thinking, shit, I would have loved to trade oil. No. Okay. I did trade vegetable oil, but not
crude oil.
But I really enjoy trading crude oil and being in that business in Cargill or and vegetable oil. But the same applied for cocoa and that business. So you can learn a lot from trading different commodities while the basics remain the same. And the S&D, the analysis that you need to do, the hard work that you need to put into it. And I also think you can learn from other businesses in a large conglomerate, and you can learn from having worked in different companies, because there are many successful companies where you can take the good stuff from, and there are many good people working where you can learn a lot from. So having exposure to other commodities, other companies is good. Now, your other question, Alex, which is also a good one, is other presence in other geographies. Does that help? Yeah. I think it is important that if you trade cocoa and dairy, that you have people on the ground, literally. I was very dependent with the information I got from people on the ground in Ghana, Ivory Coast, Nigeria, Cameroon, what was happening there. But I was also very dependent on the demand, so destination markets like North America. And one of the examples of that was during 2008, the great financial crisis, we got very good information about how the North American consumer was behaving. Now, and that information, it's difficult to get when you are not on the ground. And also some of the things that we learned from the podcast with Chris Mahoney, and what you also read a lot about in the book, The World for Sale, is that a lot of trading doesn't need to be flat price, but is arbitrages between different commodities, relative value, wheat corn spreads, for example, rapeseed oil versus sun oil spreads. You have basis spreads. Now, and all those things help if you have locations all over the world and you follow the trade flows, and if you have understanding of those other commodities. Now, and I can imagine also in Interfood and trading dairy, you trade spreads between the raw milk derivatives.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that a lot of people, when they hear about trading, commodity trading, they always focus, especially the media as well, on the flat price. While a lot of money is made in relative value between different commodities, intra-commodities, and then also time spreads.
True, but it's less visible, I guess, to the outside.
Correct.
Right? So, yeah. And to me, and probably that's something that I really like about the dairy industry or my work on a day-to-day basis, is the opportunity is really endless. So if you think about the products that you can derive from raw milk, it's endless. And it's very expensive products that come from it, very competitive products. And you have multiple origins, right? There are supply zones in the Americas, in Oceania, in Europe. All these different products offer endless opportunity to trade. And it's like a monopoly, to write on the Sunday that I used to play with my father. It's playing on a bigger scale now with a global organization where you have all these information points and opportunities, and you have a teams with the right capabilities to try and make the right trades at the right time to deliver value ultimately for our customers and suppliers, as well as for ourselves.
Can you explain us how the S&D works? Because the core of a commodity trader, yeah. And I find it fascinating to think about, okay, you have cows.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have cows and they produce basically 24/7.
Yeah.
Now, this week I was reading an article about, in the US, discussions about part of the herds being swapped from milk cows to slaughter cows, right? These type of things.
Yeah.
How does it work, the S&D and the analysis of supply and demand?
Maybe as a starting point, speaking to many other commodity traders, mm-hmm. what I've learned, especially outside of dairy, is that our S&D and analysis is maybe less developed than it is in some other industries, as a starting point. Another point, I believe that my trading style is very much, and I think I've heard it before in your podcast, is follow the markets rather than...
Follow the herd.
Follow, yeah, to some extent, not try to predict markets, but rather move the waves, follow the waves. And when something is historical high, look at cocoa, right? Well, there is a good likelihood that prices will move down, right? And the opposite rule applies as well. And in between, we have our regional teams. So an APAC team, an Americas team, and a European team that will run their supply and demand balance sheet. And they make assumptions. So when we have our traders meeting, we always start, we see on the supply side and what we expect to happen in the foreseeable future. We discuss where we believe stocks are and how customers are covered and what demand will do. But this is not a super detailed exercise. And I think there's a lot for us to gain as a business to doing this better and understanding this better in order to capture maybe more value from this in the future. But ultimately, we make assumptions on what cows will do. Most cows don't deliver 24/7, by the way.
Oh, okay.
So awesome. They are also dry a certain time of year, Martijn. But yeah, we will do the analysis in broad sense. Yeah.
Do you think that then looking at how much is covered, the demand, all these kind of things, how do you do that? I think for listeners, it's interesting to hear, like, do you speak to the market? Honestly, that's how you get that data. Is it, do you do that more on real data and hard analysis on your own data? Is that how do you?
Yeah, how do we do that? So yeah. I think the most important element is we have a trade and commercial community of about 80 people around the world. So what do we expect from everyone in line with our purpose is share information from your customers and markets openly with the rest. Because even though you might not see it today, you might influence your customer, your information might be a benefit to someone on the other side of the earth. Having that access to that information allows us to trade. So we have about a thousand active customers. So on the day-to-days, we share business offers, confirmed supply, contracts, inquiries, and we make assumptions on where and how far customers are covered and suppliers are comfortable into next months. And adding this all together, we have a feel on where we expect markets to be heading in the foreseeable future. We normally don't predict what the market will do in 6 months' time. We predict what markets will do in the next 4 to 6 weeks. Yeah.
And then if you look at, I think that you were strong always in this, I recall from our trading meetings we had, but what do you see in people when you think that they're good? What are most of the times elements, competences in the people and in traders that you think, oh, that's certain things that I think are always very useful for these kind of...
Yeah. I believe to start with, it's discipline. So you need to have people that want to be successful and have the drive to win on a day-to-day basis. So I think without the right level of commitment, it's very hard to be successful in the trading world. Why? Because someone at your desk will do better. And he will be the one getting the opportunities within the desk and not you. I believe you need to be able to connect the dots as having some basic analytical skills that allow you to sense and see opportunities, whereas others don't see it. And as a third point, and this is maybe more visible in the long term, well, you need to be a team player within our business. So you need to be able to work hard for people around you and for your customers and suppliers.
Yeah.
Because if people within our organization see that you work for them and fight for their success, they will fight for your success. And that ultimately makes you a successful trader.
Yeah.
Can you tell something about, are you, as a family member, and make sure that people believe that they in the organization have a fair chance?
Yeah.
So that you have, yeah, not kind of the animal farm type situation, but where you have a situation where people think, well, okay, yeah, they own the business, but I have a fair chance to developing myself. And when critical decisions are made, the strength of the argument is still causing the direction that we're going to take. Are you aware of that dynamic, or does it not play a role in food?
Yeah, so that question has been asked many times. And how is it to work in a family business? And what was this for you? And I, for whatever reason, I never felt per se that I never dealt with Interfood as if it was a family business. I worked at it and I wanted to be treated. And I treat also my younger brother and as one of the commercial guys within the organization. I believe, and we've discussed it a lot within the family and also within the organization, is who do we want to be? So I know multiple very traditional family businesses. And we feel that that's not the type of business we want to be. We consider our organization not a family. We consider our organization a team. And we want to put the best players in the field to make sure that we will play Champions League each and every year. And whether that's for people that have been working 30 years within the company or whether that's for people that have the Van Stipdonk last name, it doesn't matter. We want to be there for the future and we don't want to compromise on last name or track record or other things. We believe it's important to look at what people are there to contribute and treat everyone in the same manner.
And in terms of the future, what do you see as the main challenges in the dairy industry? And linked to that, one big issue at the moment in other commodities is the EUDR regulation, which is, as you said, maybe slightly different in dairy, because I'm not so much aware of deforestation in Europe itself. But still, I can imagine that. And the reason for the EUDR is, at the end of the day, is climate change, is emissions. To what extent does that impact the dairy industry and how is Interfood and how are you personally thinking about how to address that for the future?
Yeah. And so for me, also the biggest challenge for the dairy industry is definitely sustainability linked, right? So what is the CO2 footprint? It's massive, right? Similar to meat farming. And the industry as such has a challenge. So this is an issue that will be addressed by consumers ultimately, but also by regulators in the shorter horizon. And next to this being a challenge, we consider it one of the biggest opportunities. So as we are reviewing our new strategy, it's about how can we continue to deliver progress to our stakeholders and the industry and delivering more sustainable dairy to the marketplace is one of our key pillars. So we try to help co-ops and farmers through multiple interventions to reduce their footprint. And we believe that there is a lot to gain in the industry. And yes, some of these interventions come at a cost, at a reasonable price, but we believe that there are also market players there that will pay for these. And ultimately, it's to allow the market to thrive in the future. Next to this, if we would not change the industry altogether, then I think the CO2 footprint, but also animal welfare challenges will ultimately drive consumers away from dairy long term. And this is also something that we're looking at. So what kind of solutions can we provide our customers through precision fermentation or blended products with palm and dairy, allowing them to, on the one side, reduce the CO2 footprint and maybe also have slightly more competitive solutions in the future.
And there was a challenge from also somebody else on traders, and it was for, not just for dairy, but also on oils and fats and others and sugars. Like, as a producer, you're owning the plantage or you're owning the cows, etc. It's yours, right? So as a trader, it's harder to add your value in that sustainability, whereas only certain volumes of the crop or certain volumes of the milk production is only CO2, has a CO2 footprint. And that volume is still relatively small to in the crop or in the milk production. So how, as a trader, can you still add value when that production is relatively still small, which with the footprint, to basically do something with it towards the companies that need to buy and reduce the footprints, like multinationals, etc.?
And what we see is the biggest challenge today is the ability for many of these producers to organize for themselves. So there's an information gap and maybe capacity gap. So our role here is to help them deliver what the consumers want to achieve. Yeah. So our value proposition is about helping our partners to change, to deliver this change and to organize for this.
Is a trading house set up to do that? Because trading house has always been a purpose of buying, selling, etc. So you need to somehow change as well then a bit of the organization, people that you have.
Good point. So how do I look at our business? And I see ourselves as a trader, but at the same time as a merchant. So we have, and we had once a strategic session and the consultant wanted us to make either left or right, you're a trader or you're a merchant. And I came to the conclusion that you don't need to change. You don't need to choose between left or right. So we believe that these go hand in hand very well. So our ability to be a merchant, I think, drives our success ultimately also as a trading house. So being a good merchant, developing value propositions, engaging with our business partners, suppliers, and customers on long-term contracts and partnerships provide us flow. Our business model thrives about on information and flow. So ultimately, what we try to do with the merchant side of our business, which is effectively 90% of who we are, is generate flow that we can trade upon within our business. And this goes, I think, very well together and allows you to invest in both sides of the business. So therefore, also innovate, find new value propositions, making sure that you can grasp more market share ultimately on the marketplace.
But if I look at nicely, maybe you can compare cocoa again with dairy, because in cocoa, especially now, there is a crisis, there is a crop scare, and people wondering how is this going to evolve, and price is the best fertilizer. So people are talking about extension of plantations. At the same time, with the EUDR, that is going to be complicated. So the big upside potential in cocoa is yield improvement. So from maybe 500 to 800 kilograms per hectare, and maybe double that. Now, what are the opportunities in dairy for that? So to what extent is there a possibility to increase the yield of cows versus in the environment that it is likely that herd numbers are going to come down in Europe?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think the majority of the growth that we have seen the last three decades, has been on yields. So more milk cows milking way more, and ultimately the number of cows reducing. I think today there are maybe cloned cows in China that produce, I think, a massive amount of milk that you don't want to know. But I think there are, in Israel, good examples of the best yielding cows in the industry. I believe, I don't know the numbers by heart, but I thought it was around 15,000 liters a cow a year, which is, I think, almost more than 50% more than a traditional cow would produce in the rest of the world. So if you assess the yield improvement that could still be out there, that is massive. Yeah, and that ultimately also drives sustainability to some extent in the industry, because you would see that the CO2 footprint through yield improvement goes down. Yeah.
But I think that cow probably looks like a kind of Hulk Hogan cow, but that's
scary.
it's scary probably. On this, so there are still many opportunities for the world of dairy. How do you think that actually looking at some regions, so for example, South Korea is buying a lot of cheese and they're... Do you think that that will still pop up, that some regions will start eating more, much more dairy, whereas they were a very low consuming region before?
I think still the correlation between wealth and dairy consumption is there. So yeah, there are many developing countries that are just at the starting point. If you look at the number of the kilograms of dairy that they consume a year, it's nothing. So yes, there's ample opportunity to grow. But also now within the European Union, we got very surprised this year about how well cheese is being consumed by all of us. So I don't know where we put our cheese on nowadays, but apparently we are finding new ways every month to consume more cheese. And I think the Asian culture and the Asian region has so much opportunity for the high value products. I see cheese and fat and also higher proteins that will drive a lot of growth for the industry.
Do the Chinese have a cheese culture?
They're starting to consume more cheese. It's mostly still processed cheese that they consume, but also that is a growing category in the industry. Yeah.
Do you think that also, so you talked about Asia and you have worked in Singapore. So then basically how I see a lot of traders, especially the young ones, want to travel around the world. They want to see everything. I mean, you have been flying around the world already for some years. Would you recommend for young traders, et cetera, to go abroad to have that experience, or can they better stick to the head office of a company and develop there? What is your view on that?
Yeah, I have a personal view there. So it has been 4 years in Asia, and that was something that I knew that I would do, even though I didn't know that I would work at Interfood at that time. So it was a dream, a personal dream for me and my wife. And we went to Singapore with two kids. We came home with three, and it was a fantastic period. So I think the quality and the adventure associated with moving abroad and being exposed to new cultures and challenges that you don't challenge when you stay where you are, right? And where you're raised, I think it allows you to develop as an individual, right? It's personal development, but it also allowed me to develop on a business level. I remember coming to Singapore and I thought, I know how this dairy market works. And then I came to learn that, oh, but the dynamic in Asia is completely different. Hey, many of these customers don't want to work with me, right? My style is not what they like. So yes, I could manage in a proper way multinational customers and some of the suppliers in Oceania. But I've seen that the way that the locals were managing the customers in the region was in a completely different way.
Yep.
So I left Europe knowing pretty much how European business worked. And I thought I can one-on-one copy-paste that and move my route. But I came in a standstill for 9 months, swimming, trying to survive and add value to the teams and the business there. So that was a big stretch, but was worth it.
Was worth it. And it helps you now in your current role as well, that you have been in the other side from your own company as well.
Yeah.
So we asked all the other ones as well, what's your style? And you just said about my style didn't really work out in Asia. So tell us about your style. How would you describe that?
I think my style on trading, and I think already said, is I follow waves more than I try to be smarter than the markets. I am maybe sometimes emotional, so I quickly try to change, step away when I see strategies don't work. Whereas I, especially the last few years, learned that people with maybe slightly more patience and maybe some stronger analytical skills have been stronger in this respect. I influence quite a bit, so I think I'm a strong influencer. It allowed me to onboard partners and convince partners. But it also sometimes I've learned that I try to push something through maybe too fast and not listen carefully to the opinion of the people around me in the organization. So I think that are a few of my
sums up your style.
Maybe you remember that from the past, right? Sitting not far from me, Sterk.
No, I think that what you say, the ways, but I think that you're influential and push through that I see. Yeah, if you wanted something, then you would get it. And sometimes runs straight through me to that client because you had a better or longer relationship, or I think sometimes the role that you had helped. But I think that's where you see the waves. I think, that's a strategy that you select, right? So if you say long-term, short-term, going over the waves, I think that makes sense. Right? Predicting industries is super hard, especially what you see now with the volatility. You've seen it in cocoa. Nobody predicted that. Nobody predicted a war. Nobody predicted COVID. So there's so many elements that you cannot predict. So it makes sense. But then it's interesting to see, of course, now I don't work with you now, but I think that know, the development of you as a from the trader that you were to the C-level, I mean, has been probably a roller coaster for yourself as well. An interesting one to get to know yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have some more questions about the S&D. Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you also look at goat milk, for example, and dairy alternatives like almond, which has become very
plant-based
popular?
Proteins.
Yeah.
We don't look at goat milk. Why? We consider it today too much of a niche for us to add right value. And we don't see per se the correlation enough to also trade based on that.
Okay.
Dairy alternatives, plant-based. When we look at our customer portfolio, we see that our customers are not per se seeking plant-based alternatives for their applications. Yes, they will consider blended products, like a bakery, which has the same functionality, a better price, lower footprint. Yes, they might consider buying precision fermented product, novel food, if the price points come closer to parity. And these products, yes, we monitor, we explore, and we will pioneer with in the future because we believe it's a great way to add value to our customer base.
Yeah. I ask it because at the end of the day, there are replacements. Huh?
Yeah.
Now, and then on the demand side, I thought about, again, making the link with cocoa, whereby you say, well, cocoa is not a staple food. You don't need it like wheat or rice. But at the same time, it's a small, affordable luxury. People like it and they often impulse buy it. They put it in their cart or at the gas station. Now, if you look at cheese, I don't consider that as a staple food. Cheese is also more like, to an extent, when you put it on your bread in the morning, you can consider it as staple food, but cheese is also a small, affordable luxury. Now, when I look at the cheese prices over the last couple of years, I think cheese has become very expensive. And I even notice with myself, when I do my shopping at the Albert Heijn, I'm looking at the price per kilo.
Yeah.
Where I see some of the slices, they are like 35 euros a kilo, and the other ones are 23. And then I'm thinking, oh, actually, I've one or two extra slices for the same money. And how do I care whether it is old cheese or very old cheese or young cheese? I don't care, right?
They're not the same, Martijn.
No, I know that they're not the same.
You have to work on your palate.
Yeah.
You,
but how do you, as a dairy trader, assess the demand? Because it looks very complicated. Yeah? There's so many different applications. How do you manage to track that? And how do you manage to track... I'm an example of a consumer who now starts to think, well, actually, it's very expensive. Do I still take it or which stuff do I take? How do you manage that?
Yes, so we don't look at it on that same micro level.
Yeah.
So we look at it on production level. And we do see within Europe a trend that more and more milk is being produced, transferred into cheese.
Interesting.
And whereas I agree with you, cheese is expensive, and then you have very nice cheese that is super expensive, and you have commodity cheese that I consider not so nice, but that is still more expensive than it was a few years back. And I think what we see as a change in the industry is that we consume cheese in multiple products. So many of the processed alternatives contain cheese as an ingredient. And why? Because it's nice. And that
like
is
a pizza,
what the
for example.
Pizzas, yeah, but also other
in
ready meals. There's so much cheese. If you buy a salad, there is already cheese in it. And so it's in many products nowadays, we add this, and this is a trend in Europe. In the US, there's more cheese consumption. And in the developing world, there's more cheese consumption. So we believe that this category will thrive the next 10 years. If you ask me today, the main challenge that I see on the supply and demand balance sheet is where will this supply come from? So if the Western world, maybe with the exception of the US, has difficulties to scale because of authorities and sustainability practices around the globe, then I think the non-usual suspects like China, maybe Russia and other markets have to fill that demand gap in the future. Or we will see prices explode, maybe like cocoa has surprised us in the past 6 months.
Interesting. Yeah. There's a question that we'd like to ask to our guests because audience asks for it.
Yeah.
And that is about books.
Yeah. Eh?
Can you recommend any books for our readers where you thought, okay, they helped me in my business or personality trading?
Yeah. Actually, Edwin once, he was in a flight, I think not long ago, with my wife. And then actually She came to Dubai. You went to the conference there for the Dubai Girl Food. And then she said, I have a gift from you. I said, what is it? And then she said, well, here you have a book. Edwin just finished it and was actually The World for Sale.
Yeah, I loved it. And the book that I read after I started working at Interfood that I still enjoy today and that is for me a must read, and it's A Cowboy's Tales, King of Oil. Mm. And probably you have all read this book, but I believe the entrepreneurship that is shown there, maybe with some level of on the edge, I think it doesn't fit today's standards anymore, but it's impressive what he has realized and the adventures that he has seen. I think it's a fantastic book to understand trading in the basics and see some of the adventures that are associated with it. Yeah.
How does it compare to World for Sale? Because I haven't read The King of Oil, but I thought The World for Sale is like
it's nothing for you
like
to
it.
Not have read the book.
No.
The first book then you have not read.
That is a gift that you will get from me.
I appreciate that.
I would say World for Sale highlights many of the parts of King of Oil, but what I like about The King of Oil, it's about him. It's about his business. So it's more associated to, and that's also the book types that I really like to read. It's not per se trading. So I'm not always seeking trading books. I seek books where I can learn something. So managerial books or book of successful companies. I've also bought the Cargill. What is it called? Four books of Cargill.
Yeah.
And I didn't manage to even read 20 pages of the first book. It's horribly written.
Boring.
Have you tried that?
I have it unread in my books.
But it's more often from the company or not personal.
It's the whole history of Cargill.
It's not
but different.
It's a hard read.
Hey, now you mention it.
Yeah.
And that was also one of my takeaways from the book. It's about entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
And it's about taking risk.
Yeah.
And one thing that I never liked from general journalists talking about the trading industry and traders is the focus on the money that is made trading, forgetting about the massive risk and entrepreneurship that is required and usually also capital requirements in the industry. Can you share something about times where you felt like, well, we have a lot of risk, we are exposed to a lot of risk, because it's not all back to back that you do.
It's not free lunches.
There's no free lunches. So could you share, because that's also some of the nice things of The World for Sale. There are plenty of examples where you actually are drawn into a situation where you feel like, wow, there's these guys, they took a massive risk. And yes, you have the potential for financial, I think, really interesting outcomes, but things can also go wrong. And that was, for example, that Glencore cotton trade that went wrong. Yeah. I've experienced things in Cargill trades that blew up. Some trading companies don't even exist anymore. But can you describe a situation where you walked into maybe the room of your father or the board and you say, hey, wow, this is something I'm not so comfortable with. Or something where you said, this is a really exciting risk-reward proposition. Huh? So you knew it was risky, but you thought, hey, this is really unique opportunity. And we are positioned to execute.
Big question. Let me try to answer it through maybe risk that we have experienced. So maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, we were in a very deep partnership with one of our larger customers. And we signed up for a project where we would take up all kinds of cheeses that were second grade cheese, third grade cheese. There was no home for this product anymore. But there was a small shop somewhere in Australia that could turn this cheese into a very nice product, allowing this large company to process this product in its facilities around the world. Well, sounds very easy, right? We just pick up that very cheap cheese, we have it converted, and we will ship it to the markets and we'll be paid the price as we agreed upon. Through this partnership, we've learned that good faith on larger deals and especially trades that are more complex than your day-to-day work does not exist. So you have to be very cautious. So our learning from that point was, we want to say yes to everything. So when a business partner comes with a challenge, that he needs help for or an opportunity that he needs assistance with, we will say yes. However, we also need to organize ourselves accordingly. So if you approach that opportunity as a trader and just think, I'll issue a contract and it's done and it's we'll get this organized, you are ready for big trouble. So this made us lose one of our largest customers and costed a lot of money to our business. So my learning has been on opportunities that are big, organize yourselves also for the size of the price and rather invest some more time and capital in order to organize it in a proper way and leave also a professional impression behind to the business partners, then jump on an opportunity and think you can approach this as a simple trade that you do on a day-to-day basis.
That's a great example. For my guidance and of the audience, what can you convert cheese in?
So this opportunity, it was ultimately cheese as an application in processed cheese. It's all about solids. Mm-hmm. So how much fat and protein do you get in order to process, reprocess into a final product? Mm-hmm. So what we did is we bought all kinds of cheeses from cheddar to mozz to, you don't even know that those type of cheeses, Monterey Jack and other things, you don't even know that they exist. And they were pressed, molded, it was in frozen shape, and then repacked into a new shape and shipped to destination. Mm. So there's a lot of things happening, and that doesn't apply only to the dairy industry that you don't know with food. And it's not always
nice.
Nice.
What? In the previous question, just before this one, we also talked about, you said, learnings that you had. Some of the people we had here in the podcast, they also had people they worked with that they looked up to or that they said were amazing mentors or that they... So what were for you learnings or people that have influenced your career so far?
I think at the start of my career, I have worked with multiple senior guys that made a very good impression on me on and allowed me to develop in a certain direction. Most of these guys don't work for Interfood anymore, but they work at different trading companies right now. So I looked up to them and they helped me develop certain traits that allowed me to be successful. Later in my career, I started to look for non-trader capabilities and mentors that allowed me to build things that allow me to develop into a better manager and make more impact on a wider group within our organization. And I think two things that I remember most and that helped me a lot in the past 5 years is dare to invest in your organization, as this will prevent issues from happening. And it's a way to also generate more income. Driving, being responsible for the income of our business, it's very easy to fight costs because my team is responsible for the gross margin that we have to generate. So fighting within the board about every penny of investments that we will make is something that I have been doing, but I've also proven to be wrong multiple times on this. And so that is an insight that these investments have allowed us to be the company we are today, investing in the right quality of people, not penny-wise, pound foolish. Next to that, and maybe that's partly inspired by the book I read and I recommended to read, King of Oil, he was a bit of a bad man to some extent. So he liked to do shady business. And I don't want to say that I like to do shady business, not at all, but every now and then, it was good that there was a mentor that helped me also to stay on track and maybe not fight for things that are third tier or fourth tier. And it helped me to focus on the pearls, on the business leaders, on the things that are there to stay. And I think this focus has helped me to drive the company also in a certain direction that is where we are today.
Hey, and in case your father will listen when the podcast is live, can we give him some credits for what you have become so far?
Well, he has made me stack as a starting point, right? So
biggest credit.
Obviously, he has been a mentor to me. So that was the closest link for me to ask questions. And I think it also And that's maybe being part of the family gave me some opportunity that many other people within our business didn't have. So I had access to him day in, almost day out, right? Asking questions, challenging him, getting feedback on ideas that helped me develop myself in a certain way. I think today, big credits should be given to him by allowing me and other senior people within our business to do that thing. I believe trading, and I think good managing at that C level, is putting confidence in the people that you employ and providing them with the freedom to manage their business in the way that they consider it's best. And yes, you need to manage a mentor, but provide them with the flexibility and freedom and support. And I see him do that in a way that is fantastic. And he also made many mistakes by putting too much confidence in people that he shouldn't have put confidence in. But adding the sum up, it was still the right decision to take for him. Yeah.
Thanks, Edwin. Well, we're there at the end of the podcast, and I think we learned a lot. We heard a lot. And it was our first dairy podcast. So I think about the dairy commodity. So I think that's really great to hear.
Sterk, maybe one question for you. One question for you. Okay. What was the nicest dairy trade that you have done?
Oh, yeah. There's only one man that pops up in my mind immediately. I was trading with a big bakery company. It was Arista. I found this man. And after the first 6 months, I was...
Remember that trade.
I was actually really poor in the trading. And I was like, oh no, I'm not sure even if I can allow, if they allow me to stay here. And then actually I should have been also in the logistics in the beginning, but the logistical people just said probably to Edwin, please let him leave the logistical desk because this is terrible. So I went there and then actually we didn't really gain all these. And then I found, and the European desk was not that developed as the export desk. So we could go all over. I went to all fairs and then I found a company called Arista, massive bakery company that bought a lot of butter. So then actually I had a click with the purchase manager, Sven. He left the business already for some years now. But yeah, we had a click and then actually he wanted to buy butter. And he only had producers and he wasn't working with a trader. And for the first time, he got an offer for further out. And for him was surprise, for Arista was surprise. And for me was surprise to do a big business. And then actually we did a deal and I think it was first 500 tons and then came to 1,000 and it became bigger and bigger. And then actually that was the start of my career basically at Interfood. And that was with him on the butter side. And I was so happy when that started. And then actually Edwin only started pushing me to do more deals on that, And yeah, that's how it started. That was actually my best deal. And also I think it was a bit of a start that gave me a bit of confidence, that it gave me a bit of a kickoff in dairy trading. Because in the beginning I can remember that one of our former colleagues said, well, oh, you're new on the dairy desk. Here you have these suppliers, you can call them, but often they're not the most fruitful suppliers that are left there. So it was for me a really good start.
But that is when you got the name, the nickname, the King of Butter.
The King of Butter, yeah.
Hey, before we finish, I'd like to raise one more question because that is the question I personally get the most, often through LinkedIn. And now we have the King of Cheese as our guest. I would like to raise that question also to you because young people, they constantly ask, how do I break into the commodity industry? So what is your advice to young people who want to work in the commodity industry? What is it what they should do?
I would say apply for a role, right? And think carefully whether you have the traits that I think I explained, but also that has been highlighted through many of the podcasts before. And be true to yourself. I believe if you have those traits, then you also have the ability to work for a trading company. There are endless trading companies, not just in the Netherlands, not just in Switzerland, they're everywhere around the world. No. So if you have that ambition, there is definitely a place to start. And as a next suggestion, be true to yourself. You will see within 2-3 years whether you are successful and being promoted and provided with more opportunities maybe than your peers. And if you see this, it's a career for life, I guess, because it's something that you are good at and that will provide you with plenty of adventure for the rest of your professional career.
Starting commodities.
Yeah.
That's what we should say.
Yeah. On this positive note.
Thanks very much, Edwin. Fantastic to have you here.
Thanks for having me.